Good to be with you this morning. Some of you that are more mature in age probably remember the story of the preacher who had a practice of putting a cough drop in his mouth before he started his sermon, and then whenever that cough drop finally was dissolved, that's when he would quit preaching. And that worked out pretty well, until one day when he reached in his pocket to get a cough drop and grabbed a button. It was a pretty long sermon. I assure you that this is not a button, but it may help me in case my throat gets a little dried out. A man who got involved. You already know from the reading, Luke 10, we typically refer to this as the story of the Good Samaritan. It's ironic, of course, that a Samaritan would be the one that would help this man, because the Samaritans and the Jews didn't really have much dealings with one another. There was hostility between them. And Jesus, quite frankly, capitalized on that to make the point, to drive the point home to his audience, how terrible it was. Here's a man who needs help, and his own race of people, if you will, they pass on by on the other side, as we'll see. Here's a Samaritan comes along. He's the one that helps. So we have a lesson here on involvement. Now, as is the case with any of these stories that Jesus tells, we had a point made about this in class this morning, whether some of these are parables or not, whether they are or not, the point, of course, is still made that there's a spiritual lesson involved, and this lesson here could be on involvement. This is a serious situation for Jesus, though, because this story begins in response to a lawyer questioning him with what would seem to be a good, serious question. Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? There's nothing wrong with that question, but just ahead of that, in that verse 25, it says, a certain lawyer stood up, put him to the test. So right away we see this lawyer wasn't really seriously looking for the right answer, the proper answer. In fact, it'll unfold in the story that of all people, he shouldn't even have to ask that question. He's a lawyer. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about what kind of people they were here in a moment. What about this lawyer? What's his background? Well, he's not a trial lawyer. He's not a lawyer that deals with divorce. He's a lawyer that deals with the Jewish law. He is supposed to be an expert in the Jewish law. Now, typically they love to wear titles and to be elevated in the eyes of the people. They're another category of people, like the scribes and the Pharisees, and some might even argue that really there's not whole lot of difference between them and the scribes, but they're named separately, so we'll leave them in a separate group. But they, like the Pharisees, they love for people to look up to them for their great knowledge of the law. And so when he says to Jesus in verse 25, as we read that, teacher or master, he's really trying to flatter Jesus in that. He really doesn't recognize him to be the master. If he did, he wouldn't be living the kind of life that he is and behaving like he is. He wouldn't be putting him to the test. But he's zealous for the law. Paul said he was in Acts 22 verse 3. He said, I'm a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, brought up in the city, this city, educated under Gamaliel, Gamaliel was a great Jewish teacher of that time, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. But this guy's not sincere from the beginning. That's how this account starts out. Think about it. Why would he give, or at least it looks like he's giving, some honor to Jesus when he knows good and well that Jesus has not attended the proper school? Jesus doesn't have the educational background to really be worthy of the title master. That's why we kind of figure he's not really being real sincere about that. Matthew 7, 28 and 29, when Jesus finished what we call here the Sermon on the Mount. The result was that when Jesus had finished these words, the multitudes were amazed at his teaching. For he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. And certainly he did teach that way. He could say, this is what you've heard, but I say. Now the scribes couldn't do that. And they recognized that. They couldn't just come right out and say, well, here's what I say about it, and expect the people to listen so much as they would to Jesus, who could do that because he was the Son of God. They couldn't make that kind of claim. In John 7, verse 14 and 15, when it was now the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began to teach. The Jews, therefore, were marveling, saying, how has this man become learned, having never been educated? Well, how can he speak this way? He hasn't been to our schools. He hasn't taken the proper curriculum. He's a carpenter's son, for crying out loud. And they were amazed that he could talk the way he does, and he could teach the way he was able to teach. They just couldn't hardly get over it. So that's the background of this lawyer. This is where he's coming from. His question. Again, it was a popular question that the rabbis would sit around and discuss all the time. And there was nothing wrong with the question. What was wrong in his case was the motivation behind it, because he was trying to, as we said, he's trying to trap Jesus. Matthew 18, verse 18, here's where the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and says, good teacher, what should I do to obtain eternal life? Now, his motive cannot be questioned. There's nothing said there about an ulterior motive for the rich young ruler, like to work for the lawyer. But you see, the question is a popular one. It comes up all the time, and in other forms as well. What must I do to be saved? Is it just really another form of that same question that pops up several times? It's a good question because it at least indicates, when asked in sincerity, it indicates someone wanting to know what their personal responsibility is. And that's a good thing. We live in a culture, though, where a lot of people, personal responsibility, don't look to me for that. It's not my fault. And they refuse to take responsibility for their own personal actions. So it's a good question. And of course, it's all about personal responsibility toward God. When asked in sincerity, the lawyer doesn't fit in that category. Now, notice Jesus' answer here to the lawyer. Back here to Luke 10 again. In essence, some people don't think that Jesus would ever do anything that's negative or anything like that, but just look what he says here. Back here to Luke 10. Now he's asked the question, not sincerely now. And he said to him, what is written in the law? How does it read to you? That really was Jesus' way of slapping that man. Why do you have to ask the question? You're an expert in the law. What do you have to ask that question for? It's already answered in the law. Oh, yeah, it was. He answered and said, and this is the lawyer talking, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Remember when they asked Jesus, what's the greatest commandment? He answered with the first part of that. And the second one is, love your neighbor as yourself. This is all in one verse right here. So the man should already have had the answer to that. The answer was within the law. How could you read that in the law and then walk on by somebody that needs help? But this lawyer would have been, he didn't do it, but the story is told for his benefit. Read the law. The answer's there. You know, a lot of times our religious differences don't arise over what the law says, what the gospel says, the Bible says, but over what it doesn't say. Now, here was a case where the man just should have been satisfied with what he should have already known from the law. After all, he's an expert, is he not? He's a lawyer. But the lawyer's got a problem, you see. He wasn't really, again, asking the question sincerely. And we know that because of what he does here next. Again, he's wishing to justify himself. He knew what the law said. We know that because he quoted it. But verse 29 says, wishing to justify himself. He wanted to somehow justify his actions as being in keeping with the law when he knew good and well what the law said, and he wasn't doing it. Oh, he'd make a good show of it, and he could get the people to think that he was, but he really wasn't. His view of religion was to be an expert, to know all about it, but don't worry about doing anything. As long as you know the law, you don't have to really obey the law. As long as you devote yourself, like this lawyer did, to studying the law, and you could, boy, it was all up here in your head, somehow or other, you were excused from actually carrying out the law. And that is shown by his hypocrisy through this. He's not asking a question sincerely. Jesus pointed him to the law. He knew what the law said. But instead of kind of walking away and licking his wounds, so to speak, and saying, well, I guess I got, I didn't do that very well. It says wishing he kept it going, see? He should have cut his losses and run. Not while he was ahead, because he's already behind. But instead of doing that, he says, wishing to justify himself, he said to Jesus, who is my neighbor? In other words, well, it's well and good here, as he called him master, well and good to point me to that verse, but I don't know who my neighbor is. Who is my neighbor? Really? A guy that's an expert in the Jewish law, you got to tell him every little detail? He knows so much about it, but he can't figure out who his neighbor is. That when the law said, love your neighbor as yourself, he didn't understand the depth of that statement. Really? And he's an expert? That's the way he's presenting himself. As if to say, well, you know, I would do that, but I don't know how to identify my neighbor. Really. So that's the lawyer. So, Jesus then tells the story of this man who was traveling down from Jerusalem to Jericho. You look on a map, you'd say, well, why does it say down when he's going north? Well, it's because of elevation. Jerusalem was a higher elevation. That's why it says he went down to Jericho. And he fell among thieves, beaten. Here comes the priest and the Levite along. Now, they believed in a ceremonial part of the law for sure. They wanted everything to look good. And remember in Matthew 15, they were all concerned because the apostles of Jesus did not go through the ceremonial hand washing. After all, they may have bumped up against a Gentile somewhere out in the crowd there. Something other could have corrupted them. Your disciples are eating with unwashed hands. You're violating the traditions. And Jesus rebuked them pretty well, as you know. He indicted them for elevating their traditions above the law. In fact, you disobey the law in order to keep one of your traditions, the one about helping father and mother, providing for your father and your mother. I can't do that. I've already made a donation, a pledge toward the temple repair or something like that. It is Corbin. There is a gift I've already pledged. Sorry, Mom. Sorry, Dad. So they were more concerned about a tradition than they were the law. That's what kind of people they were. They wanted things to look good. Somehow they justified, as the story goes on to talk about it, passing on by. A certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. He fell among robbers. They stripped him, beat him, and went off, leaving him half dead. And by chance, a certain priest was going down on the road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Behold, a Levite. Also, when he came to the place and saw him, he also passed by on the other side. I wonder how they could justify that. They should have been people of all people that were compassionate towards someone like that, but they weren't. And again, they must have wanted things to look good, but don't get my hands dirty with actually doing anything. We need to beware, of course, of this attitude. It's easy to talk about problems that exist in a neighborhood, that exist in a community, that exist in our nation, that may exist in the church. Easy to talk about problems. We can see things sometimes, but what do we do about it? It's a lot harder to try to resolve problems. And most people don't want to get involved in that. But sometimes we have to jump in and get involved. Jane and I, as our boys were growing up, we got pretty heavily involved in the PTA at school. Met a lot of good people there. You find out that you're not the only one, really, that has certain scruples about things. You're not the only one that arrives at certain conclusions. Other people have arrived at them, too. I remember one occasion, somebody suggested, well, let's have a fifth grade dance. Well, of course, you know where I was going to stand on that. But I was surprised to find out that a lot of other parents said, no. Now, their objection was not coming from the same place mine was. They simply believed that fifth graders were too young for that kind of activity. But I was glad they objected. But they stood up. That's my point. They didn't just walk around school grumbling about it. Well, no, they stood up. And the dance was not held. Well, we were all happy for a different reason. But people have to stand up. It's harder to solve problems. It's easier to walk on by like the priest and the Levite did when we see a problem. But if we see something needs to be done, do it. Remember James' discussion in chapter 2 of faith and works? You see that how by works a man is justified and not by faith only. Just talking about it doesn't get the job done. See something that needs to be done, do it. When I was preaching in Joliet Well, it's been a long time ago, Joliet, Illinois. I went over to the building one morning, and my office was over there. Flipped on the lights in the hallway and noticed one of them was out. The bulb was out. And I thought, well, I probably ought to get a ladder and change that. You know what? I'm going to conduct an experiment. I'm going to see how long it takes for someone to notice that bulb is out and see what their solution to it is. Well, sure enough, 2 or 3 weeks went by. And finally, one of the young men said, Larry, have you noticed that light bulb out downstairs? Yeah, I noticed that actually 2 or 3 weeks ago. Well, how come you didn't change it? And I loved him to death. He's a great young man. Died very young, unfortunately. But my point is, he saw it burned out. He didn't grab a ladder. I don't remember now who actually changed it, but I thought it was kind of a little experiment on my part, maybe. But you see, too many times we walk right by the light bulb. We see it's out, but what do we do about it? Obviously, something more important was going on here. They saw this man who needed help, and they didn't help him. Now, here we got the Samaritan. He came by, and he did something about it. Verse 33 said, a certain Samaritan, I never noticed that word certain so much, until our study this morning, we got involved in whether some of these things were parables or not, and that word certain seems to lend some credibility to the idea that it wasn't just a parable, it was some actual person that Jesus may have known, though he didn't name him. So I don't know, Dwayne, you got that in my head now. But a certain Samaritan who was on a journey came upon him. When he saw him, he felt compassion. Wow, that's pretty amazing for a Samaritan who may even had personally, don't know this part, may have personally suffered at the hands of the Jews. I don't know whether he did or not, but certainly his people did. They were considered to be half-breeds, a mixture of Jews who intermarried with the nations that the Babylonians would bring in after captivity. They mixed all the people together. That's how they came into being. And he may have very well been mistreated, but they didn't know, didn't matter to him, you know, because here was somebody that needed help. Now the robbers, the priest, and the Levite, they didn't have any compassion, obviously. But this Samaritan did. When we have true compassion for somebody, we are going to act upon it. We're going to at least talk to them and find out, is there anything that I can do? 1 John chapter 3, 17 and 18. Whoever has this world's goods and beholds his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God dwell in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. True compassion will motivate us to action. I can stand before you and tell you I know that firsthand about this group right here. And you're still showing me compassion. And I appreciate it. But that's what it takes. It doesn't, and it's more than just asking if there's something you can do. If you know there's something to do, go ahead and do it. And many of you did. You still are. That's what it's all about. He accepted the challenge. And he was impartial in it. God's impartial. Acts 10, 34 and 35. Remember that? Peter finally recognized God is no respecter of persons. Well, we're not supposed to be either when someone needs our help. Will show partiality. Perhaps some Samaritans would have just ignored the man, but not this Samaritan. The help was personal, it was spontaneous. And it was not done through a committee. No, this is one of the downfalls of brethren, in fact, and others, but brethren who organized the church into unscriptural things. And they set up all kinds of committees, and it becomes impersonal. Do something yourself about it. Or if you can't, get a hold of somebody that can. But we don't want to look to some kind of committee over here to take our work away from us. And that's, I think, one of the failings of liberalism in general in religion. They take away the personal responsibility and put it on a group. His help was thorough and involved sacrifice on his part. 2 Samuel 24:24 is where David was going to make a sacrifice. And you may remember there's a fellow that offered him everything he needed. He tells David, look, I've got the animal over there for sacrifice. I've got a place for it. I've got everything ready for you to make this sacrifice. There it is, take it. What did David say? No, but I will surely buy it from you for a price. For I will not offer burnt offering to the Lord my God, which costs me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. You see, David recognized the principle there. What kind of an offering would I be giving God if it didn't really come from me? It really wouldn't be his offering, it'd be the other fellow's offering. Sometimes it involves sacrifice. Well, application here. The law was clear. The law said, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. The lawyer should have known that. Of all people, he should have been able to figure out the various aspects of that command and where it would apply. But he acted like he couldn't. Well, who is my neighbor? And of course, he should have known the correct answer, shouldn't he? Jesus asked the question of the lawyer. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor? See how Jesus turned that around? Proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands. And he said, the one who showed mercy toward him. And Jesus said to him, go and do the same. Proof positive. That lawyer knew the answer. He was trying to dodge the whole issue. Who acted like a neighbor? Jesus said, the one who helped. He knew. When we know what the law of God requires of us, let's not try to figure out ways to get around it or somehow or other find an exemption for ourselves and carve that out and become satisfied with the fact that, well, yeah, I kind of know what that means, but that don't apply to me. Yes, it does. Look at the contrast of the attitudes here of the lawyer and the Samaritan. The lawyer said, who do I help? Who do I have to help? Who am I responsible for? The attitude of the Samaritan was, anyone, anyone and everyone is my neighbor. Anyone who needs help is my neighbor. Doesn't live next door, may not ever have seen the guy before. That's not what neighbor is talking about here. Neighbor is anyone who needs help. But what a contrast in the attitude. Yet we've got some that are always wanting things done for them. They always want to be the neighbor. They never seem to get around being the neighbor themselves on the giving end of it. They just like the receiving end of it. I'm quite sure the lawyer would have been happy with just that. So two completely different attitudes. Jesus said to that lawyer, go and do likewise. What does he mean there? Go be a neighbor to somebody. That's the way to happiness. So when we start living, or when we start helping other people, then we're living as God would have us to live. Back in verse 28, he said to him, Jesus said, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." That's real living. When we do something for somebody who needs it, that is really the way to live. I think that all of us have been on that end of it. We've been on the receiving end, but we've been on the giving end. The person on the giving end benefits as much as the one on the other end of it. When you're able to help someone, they're downtrodden in some way, and you help them, well, what a great feeling that is. Not that you go around bragging about it. In fact, a lot of times people don't even know you've done it. Doesn't matter whether anybody knows. God knows. He takes note of it. But you can be satisfied that you have done what you could and helped somebody in time of need. Well, the question that we started out with the lawyer was good. Remember that. Nothing wrong with the question. It was his motivation. But the question still remains. Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? How have you answered that question this morning? If you've answered it properly and you've become a Christian, then that's good. The second question then, are we practicing true religion? Which James says, chapter 1, verse 27, visit fatherless and widows in their affliction and keep oneself unspotted from the world. Those are just a couple of responsibilities of those who have answered the question correctly. The man who got involved, he was the unexpected man, the Samaritan. One would think that the other two would have helped, but they didn't. That's the lesson this morning, for this hour. If you're here and you haven't responded to that question and answered it properly, you need to before you leave. You may have a lot of other opportunities. We don't know. None of us do. And if you have answered it and you've gone astray and you want to come back home, God's still waiting. I saw on Facebook, a good friend of ours posted that her daughter, who I knew when her daughter was like this, had been unfaithful for 29 years. So pretty much as soon as she got on her own, and I didn't know this, I haven't been in touch with her that much over the years, but after 29 years, she came back. You know what? As we've been studying there in Luke 15, the angels of heaven rejoiced. And they'll rejoice if you come back home this morning as well. Let us know as we stand and sing together.